Today on the 21st Show, we conclude our week-long series into the fentanyl crisis with a focus on young people, specifically how to talk to them about avoiding addiction. We've learned a lot since the scared straight messaging many of us grew up with.
Little kids doing drugs, it turns my stomach.
No one ever says, I want to be a junkie when I grow up.
This is your brain on drugs.
We'll learn about more modern approaches to talking with young people about drugs. We'll hear from two high school students about how those messages are being received, and we'll talk about what parents and caregivers need to know. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. Now news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We've spent our entire week on this program talking about addiction, with a focus on opioids and the deadly drug fentanyl. We talked about how we got to where we are today, what the barriers are to getting help for addiction, and we've heard powerful personal stories of recovery and hope. And for this last day of our series, we want to focus on prevention, especially what it takes to help young people avoid addiction. Later in the show, we'll focus specifically on advice for parents and caregivers, and we want to know if you have questions about how to talk to kids about drugs. And what messages did you get when you were younger? Join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to begin by talking about prevention efforts in schools. And for that, I'm joined by Patricia Sykes, a prevention supervisor with the Behavioral Health Organization Alternatives, which is based in Chicago. Patricia, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for the invite. I'm so happy to be here.
So, Patricia, I understand you go into middle schools and high schools, you meet with students, you talk to them about drugs with a focus on prevention. What exactly does that work involve?
That work involves a myriad of things. We go out to the school trying to create what's called a culture of prevention, where we establish relationships, not just with the students, but hopefully the parents. Most importantly, the administration, because they're the ones who gives us the permission to do so. And we do that by educating them first and foremost by youth prevention education. After we do that, the youth prevention education is usually a broad scope. It consists of 1 to 2 sessions a week for 10 weeks for about 45 minutes. After that, we narrow it down and become more specific when we talk about opioids. And after that, we try to introduce something a little more fun, a little more engaging, and all the while educational when it comes to substance use. And that is National Prevention Week, where we put on activities where we alert the students, the faculty, and hopefully the parents about the risks of getting involved with drugs. After that, we offer the students the opportunity to be peer leaders in this prevention effort by our youth. Wait a minute, it's called the YAC, so it's the Youth Advisory Committee, where they get a chance to make the decisions about what's going on in their community, and their peers see them being leaders. And those are some of the things that we do with prevention, and again, all the while establishing relationships so that the students can feel that we're their ally as opposed to someone in there pointing fingers, telling them what to and what not to do.
Yeah, and we're going to come, I want to talk a little bit later about, you know, the old way we used to do these things, many of us who grew up in the 80s or 90s and went through these kind of scared straight things. But, you know, you've been doing this work for 20 years. When it comes to talking about drugs with people in their teens, what have you learned about, you know, what works, what doesn't work?
I can tell you one thing, what does not work are fear tactics. They just don't work, because what happens then is there's that testing that they go through. Oh, you say this is going to happen to me if I do it? Well, I'm going to try it anyway. Or I know someone who did it and this didn't happen to them. So first and foremost, fear tactics do not work. What works is listening, asking questions. And when we ask the questions, let's take the insinuation that they're doing the drug out of it. Let's try our best to be clear as humanly possible on our intentions when we talk to them. Once they respond to us and give us an answer, there's a good chance they're going to say something we are not comfortable with hearing. So we have to be prepared to hear them and what they're saying. Resist the urge to lecture or preach. And then just let them know that you're there. It's a fine line to walk because you care so much and you know the risks of what could happen if they engage in these dangerous drugs. But you have to be careful. You have to be careful. Listen, say as much as need to be said. And again, I cannot stress hearing what they're saying so that they can feel validated. And when they feel validated, believe me, they will then feel like they have the tools to make the necessary changes in their lives, if they so choose.
You know, you're saying, listen to them. I wonder, is it challenging to get people to open up about this stuff? Are they eager to talk about it? Are they rolling their eyes when you first begin this process? How does that look?
They are not eager. They are rolling their eyes. And some of them have even walked out of the classroom. But I cannot stress enough, when we go in with that culture of prevention, establishing those relationships with the administration, staying true to who we are, when they see that you're genuine, then they may not say it, but they will then begin to see that you're telling the truth and buy into it in their own way.
We've got a caller on the line. Chris is calling from Urbana on line 4 with a question about the DARE program. Chris, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question is, since we don't see the DARE program that was ran by the police anymore, was it a failure and why is that? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris. Yeah, how about that? So we mentioned that idea of scared straight. I know some of our producers went through that old school DARE program. I mean, I don't know if you want to comment on that one specifically, but what do you think of that style of program?
Well, I was never privy to DARE, so I will speak on the things that I've heard. I heard that it did not work, and it used fear tactics. Which is why there was this big push to move away from it. I have recently heard that there may be an effort to revise it and bring it back. I have my questions about that. I would really like to be a part of whatever coalition or group that's deciding that, so that if this is going to happen, one, let's start off basics, change the name of it. Something more appealing. And yeah, that's all I can say about DARE. I'm afraid that my knowledge of DARE is very limited. Sorry, Chris.
No, that's all right. So the organization you work for, Alternatives, you have a big focus mm-hmm. on restorative justice. And I think you yes. mentioned this earlier, culturally relevant approach. What does that yes. mean on a practical level?
On a practical level, it means we are aware of our communities that we serve. We serve basically 3 communities here in Chicago: the South Side, the West Side of the city, and the North, East, and Little West Side of the city. So with those 3 areas, they are very distinct cultural, ethnic groups. So when we go in, we're aware of that. And our staff is very culturally diverse as well. And applying the restorative justice as well as trauma-informed care, we're aware and educated on the trials, the tribulations, the obstacles each community may go through. Like, say, for instance, on the West Side, it's mainly African American and Latinx. So we are aware that there may be some gang struggles there. Again, drug usage. And then there is the farther north side where there is drug usage, but because that area is known to be a little more financially adept, so their drug of choice may be something more expensive than that they use on the west side of Chicago. And then on the south side of Chicago, on the north side of Chicago, you have a lot of European families there, Polish, Swedish, those types of cultures. And on the south side, it's predominantly African American. So we're aware that each area has its own struggles that they go through, and we adapt our programming to meet the needs of each community. Now, do we do it perfectly every time? No, we don't. But we do our best to stay educated so that we can offer the communities what helps them from a cultural perspective, a cultural lens. We have a whole training team at Alternatives. We just had a racial equity training. So not only are we very adept with racial equity, we're adept with trauma-informed care and restorative justice.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, it's the 21st show. We're speaking with Patricia Sykes, who's a prevention supervisor with Alternatives, which is a behavioral health provider based in Chicago. I want to at this time bring a couple more people into our conversation from the far opposite end of the state as Patricia. Shaylee Strong and Jolie Cornell are seniors at Coulterville High School in Southern Illinois. Shaylee and Jolie, welcome to the 21st show. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
So the two of you are involved in a partnership between the Healthy Communities Alliance in Southern Illinois and an outfit called Lifesavers. That's a program. It trains teenagers to provide peer support for mental health and substance use prevention. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, but Jolie, I want to begin with you. Just tell me about your town, Coulterville. It's got fewer than 1,000 people. What's it like to grow up there?
So I actually didn't grow up in Coulterville. I grew up in Nashville, Illinois, but I've been here since about seventh grade. And growing up around these people, it's super easy because it's so small, you know, everybody in every class. And it's like just one big family. It's so easy to just get to know everybody.
Small town atmosphere. Shaylee, what about you? If you want to add to that, or maybe you can just speak to what some of the biggest challenges people in your age in Coulterville deal with.
With it being so small, anything that happens in a person's life, everybody's going to know about it. Again, small town atmosphere, of course. I didn't grow up here either. I moved here like a year after Jolie, but it still gives you enough time to get to know everybody as well.
So I mentioned you both participated last year in training to lead a club at your school called Lifesavers. I understand the training is focused on mental health, preventing substance use at the sort of peer-to-peer level. Jolie, tell me a little bit more about that. What is that like?
So at the Lifesavers retreat, basically, we learn about how to listen to people and how to be there for our peers and just listening to them. Anybody can come talk to us. We're not really supposed to give advice, but we could just be there for them. And we share the feelings of concern for each other, and we don't judge what they have to say to us. We're just open-minded, and we're just there for them whenever they need.
Jolie, what made you want to get involved with Lifesavers?
I wanted to join Lifesavers because I've been around somebody that's dealt with depression. And it just made me want to help other people to not feel that way and try my best to be there for other people and listen better.
It's pretty tough seeing someone who's a friend of yours experiencing. I mean, did you feel like you knew how to help them or didn't know how to help them? What was that like? And you don't have to go
It
into
was hard
specifics.
because I hadn't gone through any training. I hadn't had any prior knowledge of dealing with some like being around people with depression, so it was really hard. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to be there except for being there and listening. But it was definitely hard. But I just wanted to be there the best that I could.
Yeah. Shaylee, I wonder, do you think there's something about the message coming from another student at the school that makes it more effective than coming from someone who's older or even from the outside?
Definitely, because when you have adults talking to students, it's a lot harder because they don't really know what kids go through this day and age. There's a lot of different things, and it's different from when they were younger, of course, so it's not really their fault. But when you have another student talking to another student, it's easy because you know what goes on, and you might not know how they feel, but you get the idea of like what has been going on. Like, it's just the atmosphere is kind of different from, it's not as tense, and I feel like you get, they just trust you more.
What, and again, what are some of the things that you hear your peers, your fellow students worried about, or things that they have trouble with?
Bullying and substance abuse, of course, because that is a problem now with students, and a lot of mental health issues, even like stuff at home life, but a lot of mental health issues are there.
All right, we are going to take a break on the program. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Shaylee Strong and Jolie Cornell, who are seniors at Coulterville High School in Southern Illinois. We're also going to talk more with Patricia Sykes, who works with the group Alternatives, the Behavioral Health Center in Chicago, goes into middle schools and high schools there, talks to young people about prevention. This is part of our week-long series of conversations on addiction and opioids, and especially the fentanyl crisis here in Illinois and really across America. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. I should also say later in the show, we're going to hear from another expert who focuses on families and addictions about how, you know, strategies families can use to talk through some of these things. So that's all coming up after a short break. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are concluding our week-long series of conversations on fentanyl and opioids and addiction by talking about prevention, specifically how to prevent addiction among young people. We're speaking with Shaylee Strong and Jolie Cornell, who are seniors at Coulterville High School in Southern Illinois. They both work to launch the Lifesavers Club at that school, which focuses on mental health and is part of that, preventing substance use disorders. We're also speaking with Patricia Sykes, who's a prevention supervisor with Alternatives, the Behavioral Health Center in Chicago. She goes into schools, middle schools and high schools, and works with young people there on prevention. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. 800-222-9455. Patricia, when you encounter a teenager who's getting into substance use, what do you find is the primary driver for that? I mean, are we talking experimentation and curiosity? Is it self-medication? What's going on?
It's a variety of reasons that they become involved in substance use, some of which are exactly what you said, experimentation. They hear about it by way of peers. Then something that we stress in our opioid sessions, which is called My Generation RX, they start to use it because they used it first as a medication, or someone in their family used it as a medication. And they found out from their peers, or they may have used it for something and they found out the feeling was euphoric, therefore they wanted to continue, hence a drug use issue. And I would say, again, peer pressure, experimentation, those are some things that could lead to them using substances, as well as seeing figures in their families use it, like, say, for instance, alcohol use. They may have seen a family member or some family members use it recreationally within their family circle, and they feel that it's okay. And they encounter a friend who overuses it and encourages them to do it. So there are many reasons why they may be engaged in substance use. Those are just a few of them.
Which substances are the most prevalent?
In the communities that we service right now, we find marijuana usage and it becoming legal kind of threw a monkey wrench in it for us, because we come in with this literature with these facts, and then they counter with, well, it's legal. It can't be all that bad. So marijuana on the north side of Chicago, we tend to find out about alcohol use and opioids. Yeah, prescription drugs.
I was curious about how big a concern opioids are among teens, because you do hear more about alcohol or marijuana, but is that something you're seeing as well then, it sounds like.
That we have seen a lot of misuse with, for example, where I worked before, which was, I would say, almost a year ago, we had a high school that had a severe problem with that. The administration shared with us that there were teens who were afraid to even go to the bathroom because they know they'd be approached with mollies and, all different sorts of prescription pills. And they would have an ambulance would have to come to the school almost weekly because a student may have overused it or did not know what that pill may have been laced with. So, yeah, prescription drugs, alcohol, and then there's vaping. Vaping is on the rise. We actually have a communication campaign where we distribute literature so that students can become educated about the risks of engaging in vaping, because they think it's just smoke. They don't know about the amounts of nicotine that's in it, and that nicotine causes it to be addicting. And it yeah, those are on the rise right now.
Jolie, what about in Coulterville? What is it that you find drives your peers, young people, to use drugs?
Yeah, I definitely think that marijuana is really used around here, and also vapes are definitely used around here too.
Where are they getting it from?
They could be getting it from their parents, from older kids that they know, just any family members.
Interesting, their parents. That's not something I expected to hear, to be honest with you. Is that pretty common in your experience?
Oh yeah, it's very common. You could see a lot of parents just either they steal it from their parents or parents just buy it for their kids now.
Wow. Huh. Okay. I did not have that on my bingo card for today's conversation. Patricia, let me ask you, well, I guess first, what do you think about that? Parents providing these substances. I guess it's one thing if the kid, steals it without the parents' knowledge. What do you think about parents providing substances?
I am so glad that was brought up, because 'tis true, as questionable and as painful as that may be to hear, it can be true. Some parents, what we find too in our communities, they're becoming parents younger and younger, and they may not have been privy to this type of information, and they may be engaged in said drug or drinking alcohol regularly, recreationally. And I've heard this, it's odd, but I promise you I've heard it. I would rather do this with my kid than not know who they're doing it with. So that's some of the knowledge that I'm aware parents engage in with their students, with their children. And we've had students come to school smelling like marijuana because the parents are using it as they're driving their kid to school. So I am aware of this. Although we tap very lightly when we talk to our students about their parents, because there's that bond, you're talking about my mom, you're talking about my dad, so we have to be very careful. So,
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting aspect of this. All right, Jolie, let me ask you, when you, or maybe Shaylee, we haven't heard from you in a while. When you are approaching your peers to talk to a friend or a classmate about substance use or mental health concerns, what approach do you take? How do you do that?
We don't really take an approach of like judgment. I'd say we take a more calm approach to it and a listening. We use a lot more listening than we do talking because that's kind of what Lifesavers is about, you know? But you can't really sit there and be judgy or use fear tactic, as some people say, because that's not, it doesn't really help the kids nowadays. More like scares them away than anything.
I wonder if that's something that you had to sort of like practice or work on, right? Because it's human nature to want to judge when you hear things, right? Do you have to sort of calm yourself in that moment?
Oh, definitely. Well, during Lifesavers training, we actually did activities that helped us with taking this approach, because it's not always the natural first one, like what you're taught by your parents. It might be a different approach from the calm and more collected approach that you have to take. And during having to do this, you have to show your understanding and empathize with them.
Interesting. You know, Patricia, I think we're going to let you go here. I just want to ask before we do, there is a new law that took effect this month, actually, in Illinois, where high school students are going to be required to get education specifically on the dangers of fentanyl use as well as fentanyl contamination. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to get into the specifics of the law, but I mean, do you see that as a positive step?
Yes, I see it as a positive step. Well, I have to be honest and say I see it as a positive, and it could possibly become a negative based on how the information is given out. It's exactly what Jolie and Shaylee have been saying. We have to not scare them because fear tactics do not work. We have to make sure that we provide an arena wherein we listen to the students and not to judge or lecture them, while at the same time providing the information, the education that they need. And something that the approach that we take when we do our prevention is, while we provide them with the education, they can do one of several things. One, they can decide to not use drugs at all. Two, they can decide to cut down their usage. And three, they can say, hey, I'm too far in right now, but I will provide the information to my peers or what have you, with the clear understanding that that can come across as hypocritical. I like to toss that one in myself. But with the Illinois' new law concerning fentanyl education in schools, I think it's fantastic. The more you know, the more you grow. We just have to be very careful at how we disseminate the information.
Patricia Sykes is a prevention supervisor with Alternatives, the behavioral health services provider based in Chicago. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you so much and have a great day.
You as well. And Jolie and Shaylee, I'd like to ask if you can stick around for the next part of our conversation. We're going to shift gears and focus the rest of our time on practical advice for parents and caregivers with young children and teenagers. And to help us with that, I'd like to bring another person into our conversation now. Alan Barton is an assistant professor in the Human Development and Family Studies program at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Professor Barton, welcome to the 21st show. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of parents in my generation, I guess my fellow parents now, we grew up with drug prevention messaging. We talked about this a little earlier, that used a lot of scare tactics. We actually have a clip from a TV commercial that was pretty prevalent when I was a kid back in the 1980s.
Is there anyone out there who still isn't clear about what doing drugs does? Okay, last time. This is your brain.
He's holding up an egg.
This is drugs.
It's a frying pan.
This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
All right, the classic, the egg, the frying pan. Alan Barton, does that work? What does research show about that?
So when you're looking at the evidence, I think it's safe to say that, and as I alluded to on the show earlier, the just direct message of scared straight or here's the danger maybe not be the most effective means by which we can help deter or prevent substance use among youth. And as that, as some of the listeners of our, the speakers have already shared, that drug use is part of a larger conversation and larger picture, and that you're trying to develop a certain capacities within individuals. And so just the direct message of that loses some of the context of the youth and their lives and the development and the relationships they have, that in and of itself may not be the most effective means we have for helping deter substance use.
So what does evidence-based prevention look like?
That's a great question. And it can take various forms. And I think the two most common ways that we've are in the literature to date, one is what we consider school-based approaches, which is just what Patricia talked about, and the other that would be more family-oriented or family-based approaches. And we've there's a lot of good evidence behind both of those approaches. And within both of those, obviously a variety of programs, but they target multiple components to try to build up these protective factors that help make substance use less likely. And they also try to deter or lower risk factors that also could lead individuals to be susceptible to use or escalation.
I mean, what is the message chiefly abstinence? Is it delay? I mean, I think about how, like, in the realm of sex education, which is maybe, I think, more often discussed publicly than drug education, the evidence-based, at least, has moved away from abstinence only, at least.
So I think it's hard to pinpoint one specific message that is trying to be communicated. And it's recognizing that substance use occurs in the context of a real person in a real life and real community. And so as we're thinking through how we address and try to deter substance use in youth, we're trying to take a more holistic approach. And there's different areas and try to leverage you try to pull, but it's realizing that there's not just one message, that you're trying to communicate various things, if you will, to the youth of how they think, how they behave, how they the relationships they have with others, such that they have the capacities to be less likely to use, and they're less likely to perhaps put themselves in context that would lead them to be more likely to initiate or increase use.
So we spent a lot of time on the program today talking about school programs. Part of your research, though, focuses on family-centered prevention programs. What does that involve? How is that different from what's happening in schools?
Yeah, that's a great question. So part of it is kind of what relationships are you trying to foster? So within schools, as you might imagine, it's very kind of an individual focus. So individual capacities of self-regulation, future orientation, things like that, that they're trying to increase within the students. With family-based approaches, right, you're bringing typically have at least one parent that's also involved in that program. And so in that context, you're working to develop the certain capacities within you similar ways, but also you're helping that family member be able to communicate clearly about things about substance use. You're helping to develop even that relationship within the family such that that parent is someone the child feels comfortable asking to. And so it creates a context and it creates a relationship that we see often has some larger benefits because that parent-child relationship is so central to that individual's life that when you increase and when you improve that, that you get these benefits that occur not only substance use but mental health and other areas of youth's lives as well.
All right, we're going to take another break. When we continue, we will conclude our conversation with Alan Barton, who is from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, assistant professor in human development and family studies there. We're also going to hear more from Shaylee Strong and Jolie Cornell, who are seniors at Coulterville High School in Southern Illinois, and they work on a program there that actually launched the Lifesavers Club at that school, which focuses on mental health and also as part of that substance use prevention among young people. If you have questions, if you have comments about how to talk to young people, warn them about the dangers of, you know, it's one thing, prevention, but we had a caller earlier this week, for example, who said her daughter thought she was taking a pill that turned out to be containing fentanyl, and she ended up dying of an overdose. It's a scary thing for a lot of parents. You're tempted to maybe give that tough talk. We're hearing that's not maybe the best approach. So what questions do you have? 800-222-9455. Stay with us. More to come. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are coming to the end of our fentanyl week-long series on fentanyl and opioids and addiction. We are focusing today's program on prevention among young people, how parents and caregivers can talk to the young people in their life about drugs. We're concluding our conversation with Alan Barton, who is in the Human Development and Family Studies program at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Also, Jolie Cornell and Shaylee Strong, who are seniors at Coulterville High School in Southern Illinois and launched the Lifesavers Club there. And the number to join our conversation, about 14 minutes left in the program today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, Alan, I think, you know, because of this, we heard that this is your brain on drugs with the egg cracking sound. You know, a lot of us received unhelpful messaging when we were kids. We actually heard Patricia refer to this earlier. I think a lot of people in my age cohort, maybe we feel ill-equipped now that we're raising our own kids and talking to them about drugs in a way that will be effective. So what are some insights you can suggest there?
That's a great question. So one thing is just to remember that this is one conversation of many conversations you're going to have with your child about many things in life. And so I use the line of kind of start talking and listening to your child about everything. And so it's helpful to have the conversation and then keep having the conversation as it arises. It's not as though you have to ace the talk when you start talking about drugs with your kids one time, because you're just going to keep doing it in different contexts. And then we use the phrase being an askable parent. So making sure that your child feels comfortable coming to you with questions, because there's going to be some things that you know you want to emphasize to your child. And that's important, making sure parents are clear about their expectations and have kind of guidelines. Kind of here's what, and our family, kind of what our approach is with these things. Make those be clear and do that early. But also know that you're not going to be able to cover everything. And so make this one conversation of a long conversation you're going to have. And that, again, listening and being that askable parent can go a long way. Because you don't have to know everything. And that's fine if you don't. But being able to listen well, and have that conversation today, in a week, 2 weeks, when things come up, so that you have that your child feels comfortable coming to you with their questions and thoughts about this.
Listening and asking and being askable, but asking because, right, it's important to understand if there is a parent out there whose teenage kid is using drugs. I mean, it's important to try and understand the motivation for that, right? Talk about that.
Yeah, and so even from the treatment end, when you think about when youth are being treated, understanding motivation behind use, because that's going to inform various ways that they go forward. And so if that's something that you're concerned about, I mean, know that your child feels that you're on their team, you're a source of support for them in this process, and then finding means of professionals that can support and be part of that team to help your child work through this and your entire family work through this, because it's not going to be one person's effort. We're trying to put off old patterns and put on new patterns, and that's not going to be easy depending on how far into this your child is, but it starts with some small steps. And so certainly that parent is there, and then finding those valuable resources that can help try to change trajectories of what your child's at right now.
Jolie, I want to bring you back into the conversation. What do you think of what we've been hearing about, right? Clear guidelines. It's an ongoing conversation. It's okay if the parent doesn't know everything. Jolie, what do you think of that?
I definitely agree with what was said. I feel like parents need to be more understanding of their child and caring and, you know, listen better to what they're saying, because a lot of parents just like to assume the worst of their kid if they see that they've been hanging out with the wrong crowd, maybe. So I feel like it would just be better for parents to, you know, be more understanding of their kid and actually listen to what they're saying. And if they have any questions, you know, answer them honestly and just be straightforward with what they're saying, you know.
Now, that's interesting, something you said there about the wrong crowd. And I don't know if you or Shaylee want to speak to this. The young people you know in your life who are using drugs, are they doing it alone? Are they doing it with friends? Is it like that group of friends, that clique, that peer circle, they are the ones who use drugs and, you know, maybe these other kids don't? how do you see it happening among your you know, your peers?
I feel like it's definitely like groups of people. They don't just do it alone most of the time. I mean, sometimes, but most of the time, if one person does it, then the other person will want to do it. And then it's just starts kind of like that chain of just people wanting to do it, maybe to look cool or fit in with their friends.
Alan, how does a parent think about that? Because I think, I mean, talk about the role of peers, right, in this regard, and how a parent can approach that.
No, entirely. And that's been a pretty strong research finding for decades now, that we call deviant peer affiliation is associated with increased substance use. And recognizing that your growing child is going to be in different contexts and different situations they're put in. We use the term resistance efficacy in the sense of being able to refuse drugs when they're offered. And so that's something that happens beforehand where you're planning a little bit. Like, hey, if you're in a context where other friends and peers are doing drugs, what do you do? That way they're not just faced with it in the moment to try to make a decision. And so that's that bit of a one thing as a parent you can do, and often is a characteristic of prevention programs. We say, like, what context and what sort of strategies do you have to work through that situation? And then even helping your youth be able to, and this is challenging, especially in a peer context, but have their thinking not just in the moment, right? So we kind of talk about this kind of more future orientation or long-term thinking to say what could be a good decision right in the moment, but what might the long-term consequences be versus a different decision and what those consequences might look like as well.
Deviant peer affiliation, that really
I'm gonna say give it a good title on something.
Yeah, well, that's, I'm gonna say maybe that's not something the parents should say, like, oh sweetie, I'm so worried about your affiliating with deviant peers, right?
And peers are gonna be doing different things, so just a matter of that that they feel can make decisions for themselves and they have the confidence to be able to do that. And so to help your child know, like, hey, what would be helpful in this context, or what sort of things do you encounter that you're not sure what to do with? And so again, that's one conversation of many that you're just going to keep having with your child and see what things they have to say and what questions they have.
I also want to ask you about something that we heard earlier in the show, which is parents providing substances for their kids in some cases. You know, and we heard that line, well, better if they're doing it, trying it with me than without me. Is there any merit to that, Alan?
I am not aware of any research evidence that would suggest that. The general patterns that we see is that earlier initiation at any point is often associated with escalations in use. And so from an empirical perspective, I would have a hard time to be able to support that with kind of any evidence base.
Let's go back to the phones. Nathan is calling from Peoria on line 4. Nathan, thank you for calling in.
Hi. Yeah. So when I was younger, some of my friends started getting into first off smoking marijuana, but then somewhat exploring into other drugs. And I was never really interested in doing drugs, so it was really disappointing to me because we didn't hang out as much. But then skateboarding got popular. Everybody got outside. We started skateboarding. It was awesome. I bought one. We hung out all the time skateboarding. It was amazing. But then the small town where I lived in outlawed skateboarding in the entire town. And so people had been hardly using any drugs at all, like, or even marijuana, because they didn't want to be outside being seen doing drugs. But then once skateboarding became outlawed, suddenly all the kids retreated indoors. And drugs became extremely popular after that, and it got way worse. So I'll take my
what
time was, out there.
No, I'm just curious if you're still there. Why was skateboarding like associated with drugs? Were the authorities watching MTV
skateboarding almost replaced drugs. It was a small town where we didn't have a lot to do, and basically what I did was I just hung out on the internet all the time, you know. And if I didn't have my friends to hang out with. But then a lot of people would just go in and they'd get high and they'd play video games. And once skateboarding became popular, mostly because of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater game, suddenly everybody wanted to go outside and skateboard. Well, they did fewer drugs because they were outside in the public. And people got in the habit, you know, kids got in the habit of being outside and having an activity to do.
I see. I see.
The town outlawed skateboarding in the entire town. And so everybody seemed to have retreated indoors, and suddenly they would just go and hang out and just, you know, smoke marijuana. And some of them did get into like harder drugs and stuff, and some did get into really bad situations.
Wow. Sounds like you were raised in the town where Footloose was filmed. That's a conversation for another day. Alan, thank you so much. Thanks so much, Nathan, for calling in. I appreciate it. Alan, do you have any comments on that? Inadvertent policies leading to consequences like that?
Yes, certainly that is a clear case of what happened in that context. And I think it's a recognition that, again, that one of the reasons of sometimes youth happens is boredom or entertainment experimentation. And so one of the things we looked at is having youth engaged in, not to make another academic term, pro-social activities. So whether that's extracurriculars and sports or other things, that they're part of something, and that that's also another effective means by which we can deter substance use, because youth want to have things that are meaningful and purposeful in their life. And so finding opportunities and experiences to youth be engaged in that, both school, out of school, and in the home, is all going to play a part, right? Again, there's no kind of magic lever we can spin or pull, but there's various pieces to the puzzle, and we want to try, kind of, if you will, build the best puzzle we can for our developing youth.
Yeah. We just have a few minutes left, kind of maybe on a lightning round basis, Alan, super brief if you can. We had an email from someone who says an acquaintance took their teenage son to an open 12-step meeting in Springfield. They asked people there how many identified as addicts, half raised their hands, and all of them basically said they had started with marijuana. I mean, is marijuana still considered a so-called gateway drug? That's something a lot of us heard as young people. Is that still the thinking nowadays?
So I'm going to make sure I speak within the realm. I would say it is one that would be more of an entryway. That certainly marijuana, with this popular alcohol, kind of the usual suspects that you might imagine, are where often youth initiate. And then, yeah, that's the new escalation would occur.
Interesting. Jolie and Shaylee, either of you, I understand a lot of the messaging today is, you know, aimed at delaying substance use as opposed to, you know, saying don't use it at all. I wonder if, you know, if you think that's more effective with people in your age range?
Honestly, I'm not quite sure. I mean, delaying it isn't really what we want to do, especially with those higher drugs. And like you said, gateway drugs will lead you to doing other things. But,
yeah. All right. That's fair. Yeah. Go ahead.
Delaying it until they are older and can make their own decisions is probably for the better.
Yeah. I guess only about a minute left, and I'm sorry to sort of pack this in, but I do feel like, you know, I do want to touch on fentanyl, right? We've been talking marijuana, alcohol may be one thing, but now there is this deadly concern out there. Alan, anything you would say, you know, about navigating that versus, you know, the drugs that may not kill someone instantly because they're unwittingly consuming it?
So I think it's just part of the conversation. And so it's important information for your child to know about what's out there and what's going on. And so that way, you know, to try to help them start to think through, make decisions in situations where you're not there. And so let that awareness piece, and then also let them know, like, hey, we'll keep talking about this. Let us know let me know what questions you may have. But again, just starting to develop those competencies within your child so that we have a conversation together and that you're learning about it just as much as they are. And that, if you will, you're on the same page, that it's not you versus them or you trying to look over their shoulder, but we're on this together and you just want the best for them. And we're trying to make that possible and see, kind of work with them on what that looks like.
All right. I want to thank you all so much for being with us for this conversation. Alan Barton from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also Shaylee Strong and Jolie Kernell from Coulterville High School. Thank you all so much for being here today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that is all the time we have for this week. I want to mention all of the conversations from our focus on fentanyl this week, from the history of it, how we got to where we are, stories of addiction, but also hope and recovery, the conversation on the politics of fentanyl. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. And on the link for this show today, we will have resources for parents and caregivers to talk to young people about drugs and fentanyl, if you want to look that up. Again, 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Special thanks this week for production help from Christine Herman as well. Jason Croft and Steve Mork provide technical direction and engineering. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk with you again on Monday.